first, what could possibly be good about failure? Sarah Lewis is an art curator, a critic at the Yale School of Art, and a member of President Obama's Arts Policy Committee. She's also the author of The Rise: Creativity, the Gift of Failure, and the Search for Mastery.
Creativity and pathbreaking human endeavor is a mystery, but you really do come closer to it when you start to understand the gifts of not just failure, but setbacks and obstacles. I came to it organically because I myself had failed and had learned a lot from it as a teenager. But when I went into the arts, I would see these backturned paintings in artist studios and saw that they didn't want to show me those paintings, but they did really help them create what it was they were very proud of. And I thought that it would be just important to make sure that we had this conversation in public about the nature of this gift of failure.
Why do you call it a gift?
There's so many advantages that come from this process. I think we often, and we all should, want to be accomplished and have a certain level of achievement. But there are things that failure teaches that nothing else can. And that's really in part why the word gift is so important to me when thinking about this topic.
And you went to Harvard, a place that has historically been so averse to failure. I've heard it said that it's virtually impossible to flunk out. So you know what it's like to be on a success track. But near the beginning of your book, you write that even as a teenager, you were beginning to live with the gift of what it means to be underestimated. What do you mean?
You're right about Harvard, to a certain extent. Although I should say Harvard created the Success Failure Project very recently.
What's that?
It's a place where various individuals from the Dean of Harvard College Admissions, who himself was expelled from high school, actually, and learned a great deal about resilience, something he looks for in Harvard applicants. He himself will speak on a panel with various others through the Success Failure Project to make sure that we're all looking at what gifts do come from adversity. It's a really holistic way of looking at human endeavor.
Though I'm sorry, there's something so amusing about it. But of course, students who go to Harvard have to be taught how to fail.
Well, you know, Drew Faust, the president of Harvard, has said, that's right, Harvard students are very used to being successful. Being seen as a failure goes against your understanding of yourself, so you do need some support. But I think it's important to feel as if you're in lineage. When you look at the lives of so many individuals, from Martin Luther King to J.K. Rowling, Oprah, you start to understand that we really do need to master this. It's the one thing we're never really taught. Being underestimated, though, for me personally, did propel me on this journey. I think it's a unique experience when someone looks at you because of maybe your youth or your gender or your race, and without even opening my mouth, I know that I might be seen as a failure to meet a kind of standard in some people's minds. So it was a very kind of subconscious idea, thinking about the gift of being underestimated, but it certainly made me want to see how others had taken uncommon foundations and found in them strengths to have their own rise.
One of the things that's kind of comforting about reading your book is discovering how many people have created what we consider masterpieces, you know, in writing or art or science, who actually considered their own work to be deeply flawed or even failure in some way or another. You write about Faulkner, for instance, who wrote The Sound and the Fury, never really thought it was done.
Isn't that incredible? He didn't. After he published it and went on to achieve its iconic status, he felt that it was a near win, something I talk about a lot in The Rise. He published subsequent editions, different parts of the book he wanted to improve, as an appendix 16 years later. He had an experience that many masters do, which is that there's a sense of incompletion in their project. Another example would be Paul Cézanne, who signed just under 10% of his paintings because he thought that the rest of the 90% were really incomplete. They didn't really meet his goal.
Wow.
Of course. Yeah. It's just amazing.
So what do you mean when you talk about a near win?
The near win, coming close to your goal but not meeting it. In athletic competition, it's an Olympic silver medalist or bronze medalist, for example, sometimes gives you propulsion that you never would have had if you actually met your goal, and through it can find kind of groundbreaking endeavors and achievements. There's an interesting study that came out of Cornell there was a study about these Olympic silver medalists versus bronze medalists. And the researchers found that the frustration that the silver medalist had compared to bronze medalist being happy to just not have received fourth place, made silver medalist really focus on follow-up competition in a way that bronze medalist did not. And that we see in many different athletic achievements, from a Jackie Joyner Kersee or a Julie Moss, whose near win popularized Ironman competitions. So the sense of the near win, I think, is a really interesting way to look at the kind of propulsion that we need to live in a way that focuses on not just success, but mastery, as I see it, this sort of journey of ever onward almosts that over a course of a lifetime can result in really iconic achievements.
But that's really fascinating, because one of the things you're saying is it's not just any old failure you need. There are good failures and even better failures in terms of their ability to motivate.
I love the way you put that. That's right. There are better failures than others, and coming close is one of them. We all experience this sort of gradation of failures in life. One of the ways of thinking about why the near win is so impactful is to imagine this sort of scenario. Say you're going to the airport, and you get there 5 minutes late and you miss your flight. Compare that to the way you'd feel if you missed the flight by 30 minutes. If you miss it by 5 minutes,
that's a lot worse.
Right. It feels much worse. So that's the same phenomenon that's going on with these athletes and inventors and artists and entrepreneurs.
That makes me think of the Silicon Valley mantra, fail better.
Mm-hmm.
You write about there's a whole Silicon Valley conference, or at least it started in the Silicon Valley, called FailCon.
That's right. FailCon is a place where entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, and now around the world, there are many of them, go and can only speak about their failures. And we're not just talking about any entrepreneur. We're talking about entrepreneurs who have achieved incredible levels of quote-unquote success. From Travis Kalanick, who founded Uber, to Vinod Khosla. And I went there. I had been steeped in stories of failure to triumph for about 2 years, interviewed over 150 individuals for The Rise. But I was still so surprised by how forthcoming people were on the stage there at FailCon. FailCon is an annual conference, about 500 individuals, keynote speeches. But there's a level of vulnerability that comes when you can only speak about your failure, when you can't couch it in a sort of neatly packaged story. The idea that you have to take a risk, that you have to be willing to fail in order to innovate, is so critical that it's important to have a safe space in order to speak about these stories.
The thing is, we all know this, right? I mean, we've all grown up hearing famous quotations like Edison's famous line, "I haven't failed, I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work." Mm-hmm. You know, we've all heard that geniuses aren't people who succeed more often, they're just people who have failed more often. You know, the problem is that nobody actually wants to fail.
Exactly. We were talking about the Harvard Success Failure Project earlier. A woman who runs it, Abigail Lipsum, said to me, "Sarah, when you write this book, I just want to make sure you get this point across, that in order to benefit from failure, you do have to first let yourself feel pretty badly about it," she said. And she's right. I think that's in large part why we do know this, that failure can be an advantage, but we don't want to live it out, of course, because you have to go to a difficult place in order to get the sort of jewels that come from it. But then there's some stories. You mentioned, you know, Edison. I was thinking about Fred Astaire, such an icon of dance, and his RKO screen test in the 1930s was can't sing, can't act, can dance a little, balding. You know?
Ouch.
And you just think it happens to everyone.
Yeah. You know? What is it we have to do in order to embrace failure? Because as you said, you know, it feels crappy.
Mm-hmm. There are a number of techniques I've seen now that people use. I'll give you a few examples. One is to give yourself some distance from the experience. Angela Duckworth, who focuses on grit down at the University of Pennsylvania, she has told me that if she receives, say, a rejection from a grant, she'll put it in a folder and give herself some time away from it and then come back to it so that she can extract the gains that come from information, really. And that is what failure is. It's information. But some of the difficulty is when we have such pain about it that we just can't see it. Twyla Tharp, for example, she would often have someone read critique to her so that they could kind of take the poison out of it and deliver the information.
So you also interviewed a British explorer, Ben Saunders. He's a polar explorer. What did you learn about failure from him?
This is fascinating. Ben is someone who you would think has a sort of superhuman ability in him. He has been the third person in the world ever to go to the North Pole solo and on foot, and now the first person in the world to go to the South Pole and back from the rim of Antarctica. What I learned from him was the importance of surrender as a way of finding strength in difficult endeavor. Surrender, for most people, means giving up. But when he was in the Arctic, for example, and he was in sub-50 degree Celsius temperatures and feeling that all of his attempts over 12 hours to go forward were being erased because the ice sheets are moving backwards, which often happened, that there was nothing more that he could do but surrender to the fact of this harsh environment, to not resist it, to not fight it, and in that process to maintain this sort of access to the internal resources that he needed to keep moving forward. Now, I mean, surrender is something, a metaphor for it is sort of the martial art of Aikido, which Bruce Lee called the most perfect art. It's the martial art with no kicks in it. It's just about absorbing the energy from an attack and redirecting that energy into the ground, finding a way to sort of get kicked but rise up stronger. And I think surrender has a really important place in all of our lives when it comes to transforming so-called failure into triumph.
Well, that's really interesting because one of the things that we often say about failure, I think, is we focus on how important it is to get up. Think of Rocky, the image of the hero or the would-be hero who's just going to, no matter what happens, is just going to come back fighting. Surrender's a really different image, right? Surrender implies just giving up. I sense that there's a subtle difference there, but one that you think is really important.
Absolutely. It is important to have grit and to keep going. It is important to be a Rocky, but there is this paradox in life that oftentimes it's actually that moment that you surrender that you find your greatest strength and sometimes a new path. Maybe the most vivid example of this, beyond Ben Saunders, and I think he's the classic one, is a timeless example, and that's Samuel F.B. Morse, who invented the telegraph. But he spent 26 years in what he thought was the failed pursuit of being not just a painter, but a painter of real renown. He wanted to be kind of a Michelangelo, a Titian. And at this moment, after 26 years, where he couldn't support his family, himself, he wasn't getting the acclaim he wanted, and he was failing in any attempt to get a commission from Congress to paint there, he converted the stretcher bars of the canvas itself into the telegraph and surrendered himself to the fact that there was this interest in being an inventor in him and pursued that path.
Sarah Lewis is the author of The Rise: Creativity, the Gift of Failure, and the Search for Mastery.